Welcome, folks, to the Andy Social Podcast. My name is Andy Dowling, and you probably know by now, but I play bass in the Australian metal band Lord. And if you like a bit of heavy metal, you can go over to lord.net.au. We've got a brand new website. Thanks, Tim, for putting that together. A massive step up from our previous website. There is our whole discography there. There's links to Spotify. You can add songs to playlists. You can stream. You can watch our video clips. All the bios, the show details are there. Everything is there. It's a really, really good website. Works fantastically on mobile as well. So make sure you go and check that out over at lord.net.au, and I hope you enjoyed the tunes. In addition to playing in a metal band, I also host the Self-Starter Podcast, which is all about small business, self-employment, and freelancing. So if that's something that is of interest to you, you can go to selfstarter.com.au and you can search for the podcast itself in whatever podcast player you're listening to right now. So go and check that out over at selfstarter.com.au. Now, before we kick into this week's episode, I have to do a shout out each and every week, as you guys will know, that I thank somebody that supports this podcast or does something to support me personally, or it might be Lord or whatever it might be. It could be a message, it could be buying a t-shirt, it could be shouting me a beer via the PayPal button on my website over at andysocial.net. It could be leaving a review on Facebook or iTunes or wherever the hell it is. It doesn't matter. It all goes towards making this bigger and better, and it means a hell of a lot to me. So thank you very much to everyone that supports. But this week is for Daniel Donovan. Now, it's a special shout out, this one, because Daniel sent me a message not too long ago out of the blue and gave me a suggestion for a podcast guest. And to be honest, up front, I was a little bit skeptical of this. I went, I don't know if I'm going to have this person on the podcast. But I dug a little bit deeper and I thought, stuff it, I'm going to give it a shot. And I have a podcast out of this suggestion. So thank you very much, Daniel, for the suggestion. And it led to a really, really interesting conversation, which will be in an upcoming episode of the Andy Social Podcast. So stay tuned. That'll be up in the weeks to come. So thank you, Daniel. Really appreciate the support. And please send me a message when you hear this, and I'll find something lying around my house that I'll post to you, because we all love getting something in the mail. All right, so I'm going to cut right to the chase with this episode and dive right in. This episode is with Philip Nitschke. Now, you guys will probably know who Philip is. If you don't, Philip has got a really interesting history, and what he does is fascinating. And this episode is intense. And I don't mean the conversation so much, because Philip is absolutely pleasant and I had a great chat to him, a really, really nice guy. But the topic itself is quite intense. And not that I'm going in the direction of having really intense social topics on this podcast, but I do find things of interest and things that strike a chord with me, and I have a little bit of passion around certain subjects, and you know, I'd love to be able to share certain things with you guys, you know, within reason, of course. So this is a great opportunity to, I guess, hear a different view on a topic that can divide a lot of people. And Philip Nitschke has a past. He has been, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, nicknamed Dr. Death. He had a lot of media coverage in the 90s, where there was a law that was passed to allow euthanasia in the Northern Territory in 1996, and he was the first doctor in the world to administer a legal and lethal voluntary injection while this law was in place for only roughly 12 months. In 1997, it got overturned. And unfortunately, up until recently, when Victoria passed a law, it hasn't come back. So, and the law in Victoria is there, and I guess it's a step in the right direction, but there's a lot of heavy criteria around it. So it's heavily governed at the moment. So, it's a very interesting background that Philip has. And he has gone on since then. And I'm sort of summarizing this very quickly, because, you know, you guys know I like to waffle a bit, but he's gone on to found an organization called Exit International, which is taking a bit of a civil rights approach, with assisted dying, and, you know, from a non-medical point of view, which can be quite controversial. And there's a number of opinions. And sometimes I even feel, you know, some of Philip's opinions, I go, whoa, geez, that's pretty full on. And it certainly challenges me. And I wonder whether some of the things are a little bit too extreme at times. But there's a lot of really valid arguments that he raises. And this was a great opportunity for me just to sort of sit back a bit and just ask some questions and see what he has to say about certain things. And as you guys would have seen in the media the last several years, there's been so much attention on, you know, suicide, and a lot of celebrities that have unfortunately taken their life. And I know a lot of people that listen to this podcast have had friends, and a lot of young people take their lives as well. So the word suicide has a lot of baggage, I believe, and I think that can confuse the topic as well. And we talk about that a little bit in this chat. There is so much here. I'm going to put a bunch of links and resources in the show notes over at andysocial.net. The biggest thing that I can encourage you guys to consider when you're listening to this is really have an open mind and consider and put yourself in the shoes of people that would really want to take advantage of you know, an opportunity like this. And I've certainly had experiences firsthand with losing elderly family members and people that could have had a much better outcome as far as the end of their lives. And people, you know, people close to me have unfortunately suffered and their quality of life's diminished considerably. And I know a lot of friends have had, you know, similar experiences, and it's not a great thing to go through. And death, unfortunately, is something that we all have to face at one point. And, you know, maybe even changing that word from an unfortunately, and as we get to the end of this conversation, we talk about, you know, spinning the concept of death and trying not to be so fearful and putting such a negative tone on that word and that concept as well. So there's a lot here, guys. It's an intense topic, as I said before. Everything's going to be in the show notes over at andysocial.net. And if you want to learn more, please go over there, and you can reach out to Philip as well, Exit International as well. They've got their website and all the pages, so go and check all that stuff out. But enough of me. I know I've waffled on so much. I was trying to cut to the chase, but there's just so much that I have to sort of explain and put into context. And this is a really important topic, and it's interesting to hear from Philip, and to have the opportunity to talk to him is just fantastic. So enough of me. Please enjoy this episode with Philip Michkin. I thought I'd start off with explaining how I discovered you, because I guess in hindsight, after I dug in deeper, I put everything together and worked out what your background was, and I linked everything together and go, oh, I have heard of you before. But I saw you retweet an article about Professor David Goodall from a couple of months ago, and the whole thing of him relocating to Switzerland to go through the procedure of ending his life. And then I dug in deeper and discovered you. And that sort of, at least from my perspective, seems to have brought you back to the public eye a little bit.
Yes. Well, I mean, it was a very big story. I think we, in the initial stages, hadn't realized just how it was going to attract the attention of people around the world to this particular issue. And I've been asked a bit since that time as to what exactly it was about the David Goodall story that led to that amount of interest. And I think it really picks up on a couple of facts. I mean, one is it's extremely unusual, of course, for a 104-year-old to seek help to die. And so there was the immediate interest there. But of course, the other thing was the fact that he wasn't, as he would keep saying, a sick person. He was seeing this as his right. And of course, that fits entirely into what Exit has really been trying to say for a long time. But here we had a very living example of a person who claimed that this was his right. And the other thing I think it attracted a bit of attention to was the extreme limitations of some of the solutions, that is the legislative solutions that have been proposed and in some cases passed around the world, including the one in Australia and Victoria where people like David and their needs can't be accommodated by that sort of solution.
And the Victoria thing's quite interesting because when I first saw it and I saw the law as it stands now get passed, I thought, well, that's fantastic. And I thought it was a really positive thing, but when you dig a bit deeper, I guess it's a baby step in the right direction, and there's a long way to go.
Yeah.
And as you said, there's certain criteria that has to be met in order to be able to utilise this service.
Yeah, so look, I think that, of course, my thinking's changed quite a lot because it's not that dissimilar to what we saw in the Northern Territory 22 years ago when I first became involved. And in those days, I thought this was a very good move. In fact, I was one of the few medical trained types in the Northern Territory who did see it as a good thing. But that was a very restrictive model too. You had to be terminally ill, et cetera, et cetera. And for some time after the loss of that law, when the federal government overturned it, I still subscribed to that idea, and I would be running around Australia and people would still keep contacting me saying they wanted help to die, and I would be in some ways carrying out the same sort of process of assessing people and deciding whether they were sick enough for me to involve myself. And it wasn't until those views were seriously challenged and more examples came forward where I started to see the real limitations of that sort of approach. Certainly I changed, and the organization Exit, which I'd set up by then, changed its philosophy a little away from that medical process, seeing it as a medical, if you like, medical privilege for the very sick, and seeing it as something far more fundamental than that. And that, of course, is what the David Goodall story has picked up on too. I mean, as populations are aging around the world, the people that are now aging are those that have come through with many of their formative years as baby boomers in the 60s. They've got a much higher interest in the idea of personal freedoms and autonomy, and the idea of decision making on this most important step is pretty much part of that thinking, in a way that it probably wasn't for people 20 years ago, where the idea of letting it all just be decided by the doctors who you trust was something that was more acceptable.
So I guess in the grand scheme of things, just the way that the generations are changing and just society in general, that it's inevitable that we're going to eventually get to that place where people will have that choice, but it's just how we get there and how quickly we get there is going to be determined.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I mean, I've been reading an article this morning. In fact, I didn't agree terribly much with it, but it was by some Canadian academics, I believe. Irish academic, who was more or less suggesting that this idea of some form of medical process and restrictive legislation, such as the Victorian model, which, of course, the Victorian Premier is proudly proclaiming and has proclaimed as the world's most conservative, but that step is a necessary step before we start to see the moves towards this broader idea of it being a fundamental right. And that could be true. I'm a little sceptical, but it could be true, because we're certainly seeing the debate here in the Netherlands now really moving towards that idea, because here there's an active debate about whether everyone over a certain age should be given the drugs as a matter of course. Now, that's been around as an idea for a long time. It was a Dutch academic called a judge, actually, called Drion, who's proposed that everyone should have a pill. It got named the Drion pill over a certain age. Now, that's actually a debate which is gaining some momentum here. Now, that's nothing to do with doctors. It's a sort of a non-medical approach. You simply see this as your right. If you want the drugs, you might get them. Hasn't passed, but the fact is, by any means, but the fact that it's actually on the agenda for debate is something that as a far cry from what we're seeing taking place in Australia. Now, maybe after a few years' experience with a law like the Victorian one, and when I'm sure other states will follow, maybe in another 20 years, Australia will get to that point too. But in some ways, it's really lagging now, which is a pity, because, I mean, in the Northern Territory, for a brief time at least, Australia led the world. So it's rather disappointing to see it now just taking its embryonic baby steps in what has been a change which many countries have had quite a deal of experience with, such as the Netherlands, where as far as our work is concerned, it's a whole lot easier environment to work in than the Australian one.
The pill concept's quite interesting, and I've, I'll reference Andrew Denton's podcast series that he did a little while ago called Better Off Dead, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. And that sort of really piqued my interest with, I guess, the whole topic. And seeing a lot of people, you know, family members and friends of family that, you know, are aging and, you know, starting to see different things creep up and their quality of life changing, that these sort of conversations pop into the limelight. And the pill thing's quite interesting, because I think you've referenced it and I've seen other people talk about it, where just having it at your fingertips, or having the option and just knowing psychologically that you have that control, can sometimes actually lead to a longer and a happier life for a lot of people, because it's just the fact that they have the control of what their outcome's going to be.
Yeah, it's been stated a lot, and we've seen it so often anecdotally that the relief that comes across people's faces when they finally get that package in the mail, and that's talking predominantly about people who order illegally on the internet. Mm. They get the drugs, they get them tested, they know they've got the right thing, they know that got a shelf life of 20, 25 years. They can put it in the cupboard. They hope they'll never need it. But the knowledge that it's there is immensely reassuring. And as you've suggested, we see that lifting of this anxiety and concern, which often leads to as far as it's difficult to prove, but often seems to lead to increased longevity. And we see people that are sometimes quite sick, who and that's the reason that they set out down this course. They get their drugs, they have them in the cupboard, and they wake up every day and life's dreadful. But they know that they can leave at any time. And the knowledge that you can leave at any time often gives people the courage, if you like, the strength, the feeling that that they will continue. And then not uncommon for us to hear then that persons end up dying of the disease. In other words, the drugs are never used. What they've done, though, paradoxically, acquisition of these lethal drugs has prolonged life. So that's, I think, often is an underpinning argument for the debate here in the Netherlands about why everyone should be given these drugs, because it will actually improve the net well-being of society and probably increase the net longevity of society. Difficult to prove, and of course the detractors say there'll be a spate of suicides across the nation as soon as you start issuing these drugs. But I very much doubt it. I mean, people don't want to die. What they want is control.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you used the word just then, and I've seen it even on the Exit International website, the word suicide, and that word has got so much baggage over the years and such a stigma that I think even in the media, when you look these days, you know, there's a lot of celebrity suicides that are occurring. And I mean, just personally, me, you know, my experiences, I'm seeing a lot of, maybe it's just the internet and being so connected to everybody, and you see everybody's day-to-day lives, but you start to see a lot of tragedies with a lot of younger people, you know, taking their lives. And the word itself carries just so much emotion, and a lot of people will, I guess, sink into that emotion. And I looked on your website and you had a definition which you used, rational suicide, and then a definition underneath that was something along the lines of mentally competent, suffering from a serious mental illness, and reasonably envision the future, quality of life would be unacceptable, or something along those lines. And but do you find that that's a challenge to with that word itself and referencing that word?
Well, I've been well aware of the issue, the argument, of course, about the baggage that you refer to. I'm a little sceptical about the debate that often does, sometimes quite heated debate, that seems to go on around the nomenclature that's used. I mean, the euthanasia issue, of course, there's been debate for years about whether it should be rebranded, and we've got compassion and choices and death and dying and dignity and all the rest of it. The word euthanasia has... it's been often said you cannot use that word because it's got connotations to the use of the term and the labelling of practices during the Nazi euthanasia camp programs to eliminate parts. But the suggestion has been made that if you just get rid of the word, everything will change. Now, I've not seen much evidence of that, I must say, that whether they calling it euthanasia or calling it compassion in dying makes any difference at all. I'm a little much of the opinion about suicide too, so I'm not entirely convinced of that argument. But we do use the word quite proudly. I think the rational suicide is a label that I think makes a lot of sense. Whether it would change if we got rid of that word, I don't know. And of course, the suicide issue is a fascinating one because, as we see increasing amounts of endeavour placed at dealing with what's seen as the scourge or the epidemic of suicide, I suppose it leads us into a difficult it leads us into an interesting situation because, of course, the idea of elderly people taking the step of ending their lives seems to me to make, as in the case of David Goodall, probably the best example we've seen, make a lot of sense. And so he was quite proudly able to talk clearly about his own suicide. This is what he saw as being a reasonable thing. And I think part of the problem is we define this as a national emergency, that suicide is something that has to be avoided at all costs. Of course, it straight away leads us into this issue of what about elderly people who want to take the step of ending their life? Do we have to call it something else? I don't really know. It's ending your life, and so in that sense, it's suicide. The issue of younger suicide and the fact that the attempt to try and define suicide inevitably as some consequence of mental illness is something that upsets us a lot. It brings us into conflict with medical opinion. It's one of the reasons I found myself declared in Australia a risk to the Australian public by arguing, as the medical profession predominantly does, that all suicide is a is a reaction to some form of often treatable mental illness. And we strongly disagree with that because we say there is a very clear example of rational suicide. It's not always associated with the elderly. Many people make a decision that now is the time to die for a number of good reasons, some of which are not medical, and certainly they're not people that are mentally ill. Now, I use as the example the fact that if you start running around, as the medical profession tends to do, saying that all suicide is a consequence of mental illness, you have difficulty explaining people like suicide bombers, which we hear about every day. These people, I think you'd be hard-pressed to try and define as mentally ill. You might not think they're very nice people. But to try and say that that's an act which is predominantly motivated by disease is something that really doesn't stack up. So I don't know. It's an issue that goes on, and we talk a lot about it, but we tend to be comfortable enough with the idea of rational suicide as a term. We tried to hold a conference. In fact, we did hold a conference in Melbourne a couple of years ago. Labelling it clearly a conference about rational suicide, which was immediately ignored by much of the media as saying that, well, this is something we don't want to talk about. And I'm trying to reclaim the title, of course, the term at least, and see that we can see it as something a little more nuanced than simply as a inevitably bad thing that needs to be avoided at all costs.
Well, I think the rational aspect of the definition, it goes in the right direction, and it's a good step in the right direction to separate it just a little bit, because I think what you've mentioned is that people are brushing the entire topic with the one brush, and so it's very hard to then define each type of category and each type of scenario as it being unique and a different type of circumstance. And where, unfortunately, if we're not knowledgeable and we're not up to speed with certain things, then we tend to generalize very quickly. And so that word, unfortunately, just through the media and the way that it's used, is that it's commonly used in the tone of mental illness and tragedy, where people on the outside seem to be completely happy and there's absolutely no reason why they should be departing. And, you know, we rationalize it ourselves by saying that it's something linked to mental illness, which in some cases it might be the case, but not in every single circumstance. So it's definitely a challenge, and that's something just from the outside looking in that I sort of think, wow, there's a lot of baggage around that word, and I think it would be just an ongoing challenge to try and separate and make some categories along the way and some definition.
Well, I guess that's still going on, that argument, and I guess we're going to hear a lot more about it. When they publish the suicide statistics every year, and there's usually a lot of attracts a lot of media attention. Generally saying we've got to do something about this. This is awful. But one of the criteria, of course, which comes up, of course, is the suicide rates amongst the elderly, and it's a high rate, relatively speaking. It's higher than other age brackets in many cases. And people say this is dreadful. This is when I say people say this is often commentary that's run at the time. This is dreadful. We've got to do something about it. How can we make the elderly stop ending their lives and be happy and live longer? And I'm thinking to myself that I think this is almost a suicide statistic we should be pleased about. I mean, what we're seeing here is elderly people often taking control and carrying out this act themselves. And it's not something that we necessarily need to be worried or ashamed about or be pouring resources into, because it's a bit like saying that people like David Goodall should live forever. They're not going to. And at some point, they then make a decision that now's the time to go. And in some ways, we would argue that decision needs to be respected and the means need to be provided so that they can take the step. They shouldn't be standing in front of trains. They should be able to access the best drugs. And they should be able to take that step if they want to. Now, I think everyone likes to have the right. Some will take it. And when they do, I think we should be comfortable about it and say, well, that's a reasonable outcome. So I'm not troubled by those levels of those rates of suicide amongst the elderly. And when I suggested that it was a statistic we should be pleased about, that didn't meet with much support. But I think it needs to be at least seen as something which isn't necessarily anything like the tragedy of the teenage suicide rates that we hear so much about.
I can definitely understand that. And I think the other thing is, and this ties into what a lot of I'm assuming Exit International is all about, and you've alluded to this as well, and I saw it in Andrew Denton's podcast series as well, was that people being able to make a decision in advance. So when people are diagnosed with something in particular that doesn't have a cure, and you know that the path ahead is just more or less downhill, at what rate, we don't know, but the person's still of sound mind and they feel reasonably well, but they can see that it's going to be a really tough road ahead. And at a certain age or certain criteria or whatever it might be, you know, these people are making decisions to leave on a high note, for a lack of a better term, you know, and sort of celebrate the life that they've had instead of, you know, clinging on to dear life with whatever ailments or illnesses is about to hit them.
Yes, and that's something which isn't really accommodated by the legislative models that we're seeing passed. And I know the political argument is that, look, we can't get anything passed. We've tried in Australia 20 times. They've all failed. And the only way to get a law passed is to do what the Victorians do, is set up a commission, a committee, have the committee report back, and then have, in a sense, a sort of a bipartisan approach, basing it on the results of the committee. But what that leads to, or what has led to, is so many restrictions and so many safeguards, so many caveats, that, as I often say in the workshops I run, and it'll come up in the workshop we've got in London in a couple of days' time, that you've got to be, these modern models, you've got to be damn near dead to qualify.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that takes away what people want control. They don't want to just sit around, wait till you're nearly dead enough to then go and subject yourself to some form of intrusive assessment by members of the medical profession, who by and large have little time for this process anyway. Mm. And so that particular step, many find humiliating, almost degrading. And I remember that was one of my earliest lessons from Darwin, was the fact that dragging very sick people from doctor to doctor to get the signatures on a piece of paper. And it was Bob Dent, the very first man who died in this way, who said to me, do you think I'd be going around seeing a psychiatrist, have my sanity tested if I had the drugs? Of course I wouldn't. I'd just go and take the drugs. Mm. So this idea of forcing people to have compulsory psychiatric assessment, they saw as intrusive and humiliating and somewhat degrading. And I must say, me being an enthusiastic part of the assessment process, didn't even see it really in those days. I just thought, oh, well, get over it. This is something you have to do. But these days I'm far more sceptical about that idea that we have to somehow or other qualify to die. This is something that I see as a little more fundamental now.
What do you think the big thing is with, I guess, just talking about Australia specifically, but I guess a lot of, still a large part of the Western world, but in Australia, what do you think is the big thing that's sort of holding a lot of this back? I mean, Victoria's had a tiny bit of progress in the right direction, but a long way to go. But is it more about the way that, you know, our country is structured? Is it a religious thing? What are the big things that are holding us back?
So look, it's probably not just Australia. I mean, we've watched the debate in other countries, Western nations, follow a pretty protracted and rather difficult course too, with little achievement. I was thinking here about the United Kingdom. So, I mean, you have to ask, why is it? And I mean, I think the simple answer really, simple is probably the accurate answer, is in fact that it's the very effective lobbying ability of organised religion. That has been able to successfully influence the political process in a way which you would be surprised about, given the power of the church in many other ways. In other words, because they have the ability to affect the political process very effectively, given their rather weak place in society, they've had a disproportionate effect. So in the case of the overturning of the Northern Territory law, that was really, really was driven by strong, well-organised religious process, influencing specific politicians who were heavily influenced. And, of course, there we had Tony Burke on the Labor side of politics from the Labor right, still there, of course. They're still in federal parliament. Kevin Andrews, of course, from the Conservative Liberals, John Howard as the Prime Minister, people that were strongly wearing their religion on their sleeves and telling everyone that they were very religious people, and then using that particular process to then influence the political process. How they were able to do it, though, I suppose, is a sign of the vulnerability of our democratic structures to this sort of influence. And it's disappointing. I mean, everyone's saying, look, every time you poll the population, you get, it's very high now. It's been sitting at around about, it's about 85% of the question, if you're sick, no hope of recovery, do you think you should be able to get lawful help from a doctor to die? That question, which is the standard question being asked around the world for the last 50 years, and it's been sitting at about 85%. There's almost no other question that you could ask of a social dimension that would get anything like that level of support, and yet nothing happens. It doesn't translate into any sort of legislative change. Well, it does, and it slowly is, and it has in Victoria now, but the fact that it's taken so long is really testament, I think, to the effectiveness of religious, conservative religious lobbying. And it's interesting and rather daunting, really, when you look at it, and disappointing. So I guess it'll change. Now, when you start talking about something which is much more breathtaking than that, and that is that I want changes to the drug laws to make the importation and possession of a drug like Nembutal for personal use lawful, and there's just immediate walking away as in the far too hard basket. Recently, we've been trying to pressure, or at least get them to acknowledge, that is, those who are interested in drug law reform, say, in Australia, especially associated with, for example, the drug testing at music festivals and the like, people that I'm aware of there that are pushing this, and of course I'm all in favour of it from a harm-minimising medical point of view. But those very same arguments can be used about why it should be possible to drug test euthanasia drugs that have been acquired in the same way as recreational drugs. But that's very hard. It's very hard to get any comment, interest or support from people that are quite progressive, I would argue, in the recreational drug field, that they really see this as being one step too far, the idea that you should be able to do the same thing for lethal drugs.
Do you think that it's too many things for some of these, as you mentioned before, like just as a descriptive term or category, like some of the more progressive people? Is it just one extra thing that they just don't want to deal with when they've got enough on their plate as well? Because it's such a hard...
I guess so. I mean, I know many of these people, and they've often said to me, for God's sake, look, you know, it's hard enough getting things like drug testing of recreational drugs. Don't add in lethal drugs and then try and argue it's harm minimisation, which it is. It is harm minimisation. But, of course, it's a little harder to argue that it's actually less harm to make sure a person knows that the drug will kill them rather than not letting them know that, because you're outlawing the testing process. So they end up taking something which isn't going to quite kill them, and then they end up much sicker than they would have been if they'd taken nothing, and certainly not dead, which is what they wanted. So it's a harder drug to fit into the category, but I find it a little disappointing. I can kind of see where they're coming from. They say one step at a time. But these are the changes that we really want to see. They're really associated with things like that, like drug law reform, and see that as having a bigger impact on the whole question of the euthanasia issues than the passage of very restrictive medicalised models such as the Victorians. And I think we'll probably see pretty soon in Queensland and Western Australia.
Is a big reason why you relocated to Europe just because of, I guess, well, obviously the overturn of what happened in Northern Territory was probably a big thing in one aspect, but was it just because of the slowness of you know, the Australian government and the structure here and the medical world that it made more sense for you to relocate to Europe where things were moving a lot quicker?
Yeah, pretty much so. I mean, it came to a head, of course, over the fact when we started to really talk more and more about this idea that all people would benefit from having access to information about how they can end their own lives in a reliable, peaceful way. Whereas the medical profession, the medical board, were kind of able to just, I think, with difficulty, accept the idea that some people would believe in a society with legislation that allowed, if you like, medically assisted dying for terminally ill people. They could sort of wear that. But as soon as you start talking about the broader model about empowering people to take the step, rational elderly people, that seemed to be one step too far. It blew up over Nigel Brayley, of course, the character in Western Australia who came to one of my workshops, then went off and ended his own life, accessed the drugs, ended his own life, and then it was revealed that he was about to go to prison for about 30 years. By the look of it, he had been involved in what was seen to be the murder of two previous partners, and he was looking at a long prison sentence in Western Australia. So he, it seems in retrospect, made the rational decision. I would have seen it as a rational decision, perhaps to end his life rather than go to prison. But as soon as that received a lot of publicity, of course, what people were saying is, oh, well, we're prepared to accept this idea where you're talking about helping terminally ill people, that is, those that are just about to die, get this information. But now you're talking about helping well people, as is Nigel Brayley, to take this step. And that's too far. Then, hence, I then was declared, the medical board said I was a danger to the Australian public, and they, of course, took away my registration. Then it went for a protracted court battle, and I got it back again. And then the final straw, though, then was they said, well, you've got your medical license back again, but you cannot edit the book. You cannot author the book that you've written, I've written with my partner, Fiona Stewart, which is a handbook on how you can end your life, the Peaceful Pill Handbook. They say you cannot be an author of that and be a doctor. So I thought that was just the end then. So I thought, well, this has become the world's best-selling guidebook on how to end your life. It's wanted around the world, the book is. It's banned in Australia. It's banned in New Zealand, the only places in the world where it is banned. In fact, it's the only book the Australians have banned in the last 50 years. So, I mean, that just struck me as being the limit. So I thought, well, I'd rather be an author of a book which I see as important than holding onto a piece of paper which says I can practice medicine in Australia. So I symbolically burnt my registration and headed overseas. And I must say that the debate here, I was in Switzerland for a while where the debate's very interesting, but here in the Netherlands, it's extremely open. And the fact is that we can actually openly discuss issues like, should people have access to these drugs? Should they or shouldn't they? Is that good or bad for society? Now, that debate takes place in an open way here, in a way that I can't even imagine it taking place in Australia. And that's, of course, the reason why, that's the main reason why we're here, because it's much more open, interesting, and rewarding place to work. And I find I found it almost suffocating in Australia to have to run the debate in that extremely restrictive way, even though, and this is the most embarrassing thing, we were the world leaders. I mean, we had the Northern Territory, not known to be a progressive leader in anything. Suddenly, out of nowhere, thanks to Marshall Perrin, his perception and innovation and well ahead of his time, brings about change that no one else has ever seen in the world. And something that we should be extremely proud about has just then sunk back into the mire. And as they often say, Australia's been in the dark ages ever since, and it's disappointing.
You mentioned before with, you know, back in when this law was, open and being able to use in 96, and at that time you used that scenario of that one gentleman who, you know, you took him around and he had to get all these different tests and meet all the criteria to be able to progress. And you sort of had that sort of off comment by saying, you know, well, you know, tough, this is what you got to do. And your views, as you mentioned, have changed dramatically. Was there ever a point where you thought, I need to really sort of get into the public eye about this? Because you've had, I mean, obviously there was probably a lot of unwanted media attention in the 90s when you were involved with it all. But has it become something that you, over time, you just thought, well, I need to get more and more into the public eye? Was it something that's happened in later years, or is it something that sort of sat there from earlier in the piece?
There's always been intense media interest and public interest in the whole process, of course, and I suppose that's not surprising. I mean, it's an issue which everyone has an opinion on, and which is one of the reasons why I'm sceptical about the medical profession thinking that they should run this debate, because everybody knows about how they wish to die, and it's not the domain of the experts necessarily. So and it attracts a lot of attention. So people all got their various views, and so they want to know what's going on. It brings up a lot of fascination. I found, of course, when I built the machine that allowed people like Bob Den and those four who used the Darwin Law, so that they could press a button that immediately attracted a huge amount of attention around. Everyone said, "Oh my God, here's a machine which kills you." And and then there was a debate about what should happen to the machine. And then, of course, it was acquired by the Powerhouse. And when the law was overturned, it was acquired by the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. Suddenly there's a debate in the Senate, and senators saying they didn't want one in particular, said that they didn't want children of the nation being traumatized by that obscenity. And the Powerhouse Museum reneged on the deal and said, "Well, we can't display it. It'll have to be in there. We'll have to keep it in the basement for a few years before we can put it on display." And I said, "How long is a few years?" And the curator, Megan Hicks, said, "Oh, well, it could be about a decade." So it was at that stage I started to realise that there were some problems in Australia, and it was all about almost immediately. I was contacted by the British Museum, and they said they wanted it in London, and now the machine sits in its glass case in London with thousands of school children filing past seemingly untraumatised by the obscenity. So, I mean, it's a different approach, and, of course, it's obviously easier perhaps to display in London where the country's not involved and it's got its labelling, you know, Australian Euthanasia Machine. But by the same token, it did say something about Australian society and willingness to openly debate the issue. But it's always been a major interest, public interest. Never been difficult, shall we say, to get media interest in the topic. Whether it's been particularly helpful, I don't know. Certainly most people know about it and think about it. And of course, David Goodall case, I think, was great because it really got them to think not only about the idea of the issue that everyone supports, that is, elderly people should have this option if they're dying, but to think in the broader, on the broader issues. And that really did, I see, as a mark, a bit of a turning point. I think we are really starting to see a move towards a model, or the models that I see as being much more appropriate for a changing world.
I think that story in particular, certainly just in my circles and the people that I talk with, has been a big game changer. I think watching and listening to somebody talk and explain themselves and rationalise and justify what their wishes are, and to see the lead up of getting to that point, I think a lot of people warmed to him and to his views and thought, you know what, this completely makes sense. And to see somebody like him to have that type of, you know, lifespan at 104 and, you know, being able to sit there and explain, you know, his rationale around it, I think a lot of people sort of were just really connected to it. And I think they could find some sort of connection with him and compare it to their own life and their own family. Yes. Grandparents, people that have passed on now. And if anything, and I've spoken to some close friends of mine that have unfortunately lost parents to horrible diseases, and they just, I mean, the thing that they see when they see articles like that, they just think, geez, I wish my mum or my dad were able to have that option. But instead they had to go through, you know, it was hell.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it did have that big impact, because he'd been he joined Exit when he was about 20 years ago, when he was 80, of course. I mean, most of our members are, most of the people who join Exit are in that age bracket. So he joined it when he was 80, and obviously having little thought that he might be still a member 20 years later. But he had always been a person who articulated those views, that he was motivated by his background, his science. He saw this as being a very rational process, that death was inevitable, that one should be able to take steps to have that control. It was nothing new. He talked about it, had been talking about it for ages. So it didn't come as a huge surprise, I suppose. What was a bit of a surprise, of course, was that when he attempted to end his life in Perth, it failed. And then he started to see the other side of the coin, because once you attempt to end your life and you do fail, you find yourself rapidly, you can find yourself rapidly in the clutches of the medical profession, who then decide that you're a risk to yourself. Mm. He was a person who was known to be possibly suicidal. Well, he wasn't possibly suicidal, he was suicidal. He said, "Now is the time to die." And so they just started putting imposing restrictions on him, because he was a risk to himself. He had to be protected from himself. And it was in that context that talking to him, it wasn't just a matter of him trying a different approach to end his life, because he was being strongly supervised at that point. Really, the only option at that stage, I thought, well, probably the best one, but the only one, but certainly one of the better options, was to make use of the SWIFT system and get the hell out of Australia. Mm. So I put it to him, and I wasn't too sure what he would say. I mean, I just had no idea. In fact, I was rather surprised. But he just said straight away, yeah, let's do it. Let's go. I want to go. And then it was a question about trying to get him a place in Switzerland, because the waiting time is, oh, well, three or so months, usually a bit longer sometimes, depending on whether you're talking about Dignitas or the other, or Life Circle. But we managed, when I finally managed to get him a place in August, he's there despondent again, saying that's an awful long time. And so then we tried again. We managed to get him a special place on Ascension Day, which is a public holiday in Switzerland. Hmm. And he was able to take advantage of that. And then it was just a matter of getting him out of the country. But, I mean, that whole thing that he had to run away from a country where he'd been happily productive part of for the last, 50 years or however long he'd been in Australia for 70 years or something, was I think, rather disappointing, and certainly disappointed him. Mm. That this idea that he had to go to a foreign country where he could have his views, in a sense, respected.
Yeah. And it's quite funny, just taking a few steps back about, his first attempt and then what was put on him, those restrictions. I mean, depending on how you look, it's a bit of a joke, really, because, I mean, you could almost look at it that, the medical profession and whoever's putting these restrictions on him, is they're killing him in a different type of way. So really, I mean,
yes,
it's if who's worse? It's the devil. It's just it's ridiculous that people think that we're protecting people, and we're ensuring that they remain happy and alive, and being alive is equal or equates to instant happiness. And if anything, it makes people suffer more in certain circumstances. So it's quite, I mean, it's ridiculous when it's explained like that, and you realize that people just are so desperate for the control to stay away from the individual.
Yeah, they do. I mean, it's a sort of inevitable, I suppose, sort of death is always a bad thing. I mean, David didn't see it in those terms, although he did. He sort of welcomed death. So he's almost looking forward to it.
Mm.
And so this idea that that it must be avoided at all costs. And I mean, people often talk about this as one of the adverse consequences of changes to thinking about giving people choice. And this idea is often suggested that there will be people subjected to pressure, that there will be pressure placed on the elderly to do the right thing. And because of this influence, perhaps from avaricious family members, to try and encourage the elderly to go off and kill themselves will be an inevitable bad consequence of any legislative change. Now, that argument is run all the time. But I think what we see, and my counter, I think a common counter to that, the one I use mostly, is the fact that in the society we have now, we see the converse. We see pressure being exerted, not only by authorities, but also by family, to keep people alive, often against their wishes. And so it's not uncommon for us to have people come along and say, look, I don't want to do another round of chemotherapy, but my daughter and my son are insisting. They say, keep fighting.
Mm.
I don't want to fight. I want to die. And so what we're seeing there is tyranny currently being the current existence of tyranny and influence and manipulation by family members, often in the other way, in the other direction, that is to keep people alive. So I don't see that as being an inevitable bad consequence of changing the law in some way that might redress the balance a little, and allow some sort of redress the idea of allowing people to actually have influence and decision-making ability.
And I think, I mean, it's human nature, and it's like anything that we do, any decision that we make in society, there's always going to be a percentage of people that take advantage or use something in the wrong way. And nothing's foolproof and nothing's completely perfect. And I guess it's a case that you weigh up the pros and cons of whatever the scenario is and try and mitigate the risk as best as you can, and be smart and thoughtful about it as far as, the approach that you take. And I think just because it's, generation after generation, we're stuck in tradition, and a lot of traditions embedded in, cultural, religious sort of, framework as well. And we fear death, and we think that death is, something that, you know, once someone moves on, then that's it. And it's a desperate feeling. And so from a family member, they sit there desperately to try and make sure that family member stays with them. And it's purely from a selfish point of view, but a place of fear as well. And it's people not having, I don't know, the right type of education, I should say, not being educated, but not the right type of education to open their minds up a little bit and look at it from a different perspective, because it's about compassion, I guess, in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, well, that's right. Hopefully when we get to a situation where these issues are discussed and openly debated, and I see real change. But we can only hope for that. I see the changes, though, and I see some of those things looking better than we've ever seen. And this is, of course, the follow-on. The dust is still settling a little from the David Goodall experience. We're still having a lot of feedback from it. Stuff is coming in every day from around the world about it. And it's been the most important part of the thing that Exit's been involved in for a long time. So we're quite pleased to see the debate open up in this way.
Yeah, I think it's definitely getting discussed a lot more. I mean, even just personally, or maybe it's just the case that once one person sort of opens their eyes up and looks into the topic a little bit more, that suddenly you can see it being talked about a lot more. So it might be a case of that, but it appears that the conversation's there and it's getting discussed a lot more. And the David Goodall story obviously has been a big driver here in Australia for that conversation to continue on. A question that I have for you, you know, going back to 96 when that law came into place, leading up to that, I'm assuming that it just wasn't an overnight thing where you suddenly got the memo and then you can progress and start, you know, providing this service to people. Was there something leading up to 96 or earlier in the 90s that you had an experience yourself, like somebody close to you or somebody that you'd met during your medical practice that really sort of sparked this feeling or even just the, you know, the belief of giving people that choice?
No, it wasn't as if I had any particular personal experience. I mean, I did medicine very late in life as a sort of a geriatric student. I went back and retrained. And I was up in Darwin because that's where it was my home, doing sort of my early years of following medicine, following graduation. When I just heard about it on the radio that the leader of the government, that is Marshall Perrin, was about to introduce a law which would allow terminally ill people to get help to die, and I thought, good idea, and rolled over and went back to sleep. I just thought it was a sensible thing, and I was then totally taken aback by the developments in the next week, which were really a huge outcry, not only from the churches, but also from the medical profession, my new profession, who were saying, this is outrageous, this is dreadful. The AMA said they would never support it, and then they went one step further and said there isn't a doctor in the territory who would have anything to do with this law. In other words, they were saying, you can think it's a good idea to the political process, but even if you pass this law, you won't get any support from the medical profession. And that's how I got involved. I got involved politically because I thought that's wrong. Ran around and managed to find 20-odd doctors who it was hard going. I managed to find 20-odd doctors and we took out a full-page ad saying that's not true. We have got support. There's not a lot of support, but there's enough support to get this law working. Although having said that, when the law did pass, and this, so that was all about a year before the law passed. So I got involved in the politics of it. And when it did pass, suddenly it was crunch time for me. I had to start thinking about what I was going to do because now I'd become known as a doctor who supported it, one of the few doctors who supported the idea behind it, even and specifically opposing the views of the Australian Medical Association on that issue. But it was really from an argument that this is what I would think as being sensible. It was popular with local people. Most people thought it was a good idea. So, I mean, I was just expressing my own views. I thought it was a good idea. I would want that option myself, but it wasn't as if I had experiences with some family member that had a difficult death or anything of that nature. It had little to do with seriously ill, that is, dying terminal type people. I mean, the medical work that I was doing was in drug work with drugs of addiction, recreational drugs and the like. So, I mean, and that's often been brought up was the fact that, oh, well, I had no experience with the elderly, had no experience with palliative care, et cetera, et cetera. But as I said, it was something that I saw as being a clear something I think was just sensible. And so I was taken aback by this profession of mine, my new profession, having what I saw as the arrogance and insufferable arrogance that to come along and try and tell the broader population the way they should be thinking about something as fundamental as death. I mean, people have their own views, and for a profession to come along and say, look, we're the experts and we know what you should be thinking, I think brings out the worst aspects of not just medicine, but it's an example of a profession that I think is exceeding its authority, and that was why I got involved. So that's how it happened, but, I mean, the reality was that having got into the situation of getting the law passed, then we did have huge trouble. The first person who came to Darwin to try and use the law, I couldn't get it to work because I couldn't find doctors who would come and see him. That was Max Bell, a taxi driver from Broken Hill, who drove all the way north to die, and I ran around and spent about a month trying to find doctors who would come along and see him in hospital and sign his papers, and I could not get a single doctor to do it. And in the end, he ended up getting back in his car and, much to my surprise, managed to drive all the way back to Broken Hill, where he died a few weeks later. Now, that was an example of a law that had been passed, but effectively being frustrated by the profession. And I got rung up by the College of Physicians head in the Territory shortly after that event, saying, you've got your law, but it's never going to work because we won't let it work. That is, which of course explains some of my antipathy towards the medical profession, because I didn't appreciate what they had done. On the other hand, when it did go to air, the story about that person's failure, Max Bell's failure, it went to air in Four Corners on a show called Road to Nowhere, which summed up his trip to Darwin and his failure. I got rung up the next day after it went to air by one of the eminent surgeons of the North, who had actually watched the television, had refused to help Max. All he had to do was come along and sign his paper to say he was terminally ill, which was obvious at 20 metres. But in any event, he rang me up the next day and said, I've just seen your patient on television, and I feel like shit. He said, next time it happens, give me a call and I'll sign the papers. And, of course, that was Bob Dent a few weeks later. So it changed. What that did was show me how important the media was for making effective social change, especially television. It made a huge impact seeing him there rather than talking about him. But it also showed, I suppose, the battle that we were going to have to try and ultimately keep that law in place with such strong and active opposition from the profession, from the medical profession.
Was it a pretty overwhelming time to, you know, in your life personally? I mean, I think there was four people that utilised the service in that period of time while the law was active.
Yeah, it was a very intense time, of course. I mean, it's certainly nothing that you can easily forget. And it was it hasn't been duplicated to that level of intensity at all since that time. Although it's always an issue, and I'm kind of glad that I got into the issue as almost accidentally. As I said, I heard about it on the radio. It certainly hadn't been something that I thought about. I don't think they mentioned the euthanasia word once during medical school. So it wasn't something that had been, you know, something that I'd been worrying and thinking about at all. But having got involved in it in that way, in a sort of serendipitous way, I'm very pleased that I did, because it's quite interesting and it's important. I like what I'm doing. It is a cutting edge social issue, which I'd rather be involved in. I mean, it's a lot, in some ways I stop and say it's a lot more fun than it was writing out prescriptions for penicillin or something. Not that there's anything wrong with writing out prescriptions for penicillin, and some very good people do it, but this is an important issue, and I'm glad to be involved in an important issue.
Over the years, I mean, you would have copped so much from all different corners of people and groups, and received criticism and probably more extreme versions in certain circumstances. One of the questions I was thinking about when I was trying to put together some notes to ask you of how you deal with this and how you manage it over the years, and you know, what sort of resilience you have, and you clearly have some because you're still out there campaigning a lot of this. You know, what have you done? Is it something, I don't know. I mean, I know that you did, you know, you've done a stint of comedy at one point, which I was quite surprised at. And I thought, oh, that's really sort of, it's left field. Is that something, or is there other things that you've utilized to sort of help you balance yourself out with some of the friction that you've experienced?
No, the comedy thing was really, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me as I've been involved in this issue, or not just this issue, but this issue, there's many things that occur which, of course, lend themselves to a certain, if you like, black comedy. And it's something which, of course, has an intrinsic interest in general, not necessarily the comedy aspect, but the whole topic is interesting. So it did occur to me that one might marry the two. That, again, was somewhat accidental in the sense that a person who was very sick, a comedian, contacted me wanting some information to help her for her decision that she was thinking about taking about ending her life. And we got, of course, talking, and she explained that she was a comedian. And I said, well, I've always wanted to be a comedian. I mean, it was a sort of one of those things which you just say. She said, well, why don't you, do you want to share a stage? I've got a show coming up in Edinburgh for the comedy festival. Do you want to share the stage? And I was so taken aback by this. Oh, what a great opportunity. And also, that was just at the time when we were in the middle of the court proceedings to try and get my license back after they'd taken it away from me or suspended it. So it seemed like a good opportunity to try something which is sort of sitting out there, something you'd kind of like to try but never quite get around to it. And it turned out to be a very, very interesting and somewhat harrowing experience, but one that I'm quite pleased I did. I can't see myself anxiously trying to get back to another comedy festival in the near future again. But I mean, it was something, one of those things which I'm pleased to have done, and I must say, it gave me a whole new respect for those who are successfully able to live that way. That's a hard road, I think, being a comedian. In terms of trying to marry that topic and portray it in this amusing and entertaining way to try and thus involve a different section of the community, because here we're talking predominantly about young people coming along, I thought it was an interesting exercise. I mean, most of the time when I give a talk, the average age will be, and I'll be giving in London on Saturday, the average age would be 70, 75. It's usually not something that young people have enough interest in to want to go off and actually become part of a talk about. I mean, but if they could see it as something that might be entertaining, that is, and you know, they could enjoy, well, that was a worthwhile thing to do. And for that sense, it was worth doing.
I was definitely taken back by it. And I mean, the way that you've explained it certainly makes a lot more sense. But even at the time, I thought, it's a way to cut through a lot of noise and reach different types of people and in a different format and a different type of medium. And I think it's very different and unexpected. And I think that's part of the secret to a lot of these things of getting awareness and getting people to talk about, is that not the best word to use, but you have to shock people in a way to get them, to change their regular sort of perceptions or stereotypes or whatever they're normally thinking of where particular things lie in life and in society. And to have somebody like yourself with your history and your presence in the media and all of the flack that you've copped over the years to then go into that sort of setting is quite remarkable.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, it was good. It was a good experience. And I said, there's a lot of very funny things that, have taken place over the years involved in this issue and, getting people to put themselves sometimes in the shoes of these people that tread these rather difficult paths at the end of their lives is something that, one invited the audience to do and, with greater or lesser degrees of success. So, yeah, no, I was pretty pleased at the reaction. I suppose it's nice to have it out there as another thing. If I had a bit more time, I might think about doing it again. The reality is that we're kind of flat out now. Because there's so much happening and really pushing this broader idea of the future, and it's trying to develop the new device that I'm working on, the Sarko machine. We want to get that down into Switzerland to allow people to see death not just as something which is, this sort of behind closed door private miserable experience, but something which is, as I say, with elegance and style, and something that might even be, don't think enjoyable is the right word, but something which has got some sort of different approach to it, to try and reconceptualize death in that way using this rather futuristic device. It seems to, again, have attracted a lot of attention. I guess I shouldn't be too surprised, but it certainly attracted attention again from people around the world. And so now there's about 5 different documentary teams that are all following the development of the Sarco to see whether what we're seeing here is, I think, a fundamental change in the way the world deals with death. And that's something which I'm pretty excited about.
Well, not that it's the best credible resource on the internet, but I was looking at your Wikipedia page, which I was quite impressed. There's quite a bit of information on there. But one of the, I mean, you've been unfortunate to have a couple of nicknames along the way, just due to, I guess, you being in the public eye and your past. But one of them, which I sort of scratched my head and went, oh, okay, this is interesting, was, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if this is not something that's been referred to you, but it, on the page it said that some people have referred you to the Elon Musk of assisted suicide. And I thought, oh,
yes, that's right.
I thought that's quite, that was unexpected. And then obviously you're talking about technology now and things like that. I thought, oh, maybe that's the link that people are referring to.
Yeah, that came up in the Newsweek article about the Sarco machine, because the person, the journalist, I think, looked at it and said, that looks like a Tesla. And I said, well, yes, I made the comment about, yeah, I was very impressed by that. I'm very impressed by that technological development. The interview was about technology changing the face of death and dying. And then I found that label and I thought that was quite nice. I wasn't going to complain about it. But yeah, the idea is, I mean, technology is changing the face of everything. And it'd be naive to think it's not going to change the face of death and dying and the way we view it. So that's a pretty exciting area, and that's where, of course, most of our endeavours are now directed.
Well, I think changing the perception of what death is, and you know, historically we've touched on this a couple of times along the way about, you know, people putting a negative connotation on death and viewing it in fear. And there was another organisation, and I think they've changed their name. I need to look them up, but it's an American-based organization that's been putting together a concept of an eco-friendly burial system, where it's some sort of I'm not going to describe this very well, but it's like a silo in a way, and you're burying people in this silo, and they become part of the earth, and it's something to it's almost like, I'm not describing this very well, but it's almost like a compost sort of thing, but they put it in a really elegant way where there's a ceremony attached to it, but it's celebrating this person and bringing them back to the earth where they're contributing to the globe, to the earth, and they're, you know, providing value still even after they're gone. And that was a really interesting example, because I thought you're breaking those stigmas. You're breaking the stereotypical sorrow and horrible fears and anxiety that's associated with death, and in a way, you know, really sort of celebrating that this person is continuing to impact other people and impact society and life and the earth by returning to it.
Yeah, that's interesting, because we launched the Sarco at the Amsterdam Funeral Fair, and of course there are a lot of people there exhibiting different things and talking about different concepts. And there I had a look at some of these new developments, which are along the lines that you've just been talking about, some of the more eco-friendly ways of disposing of the human body in a way that it's much more nurturing for the planet and much less damaging in the form of greenhouse gas production, etc. And it's a fascinating amount of work is going along in that area, and I again see that as being this interface between modern technology and death and dying. And hopefully, one hopes that if enough is done in enough time, we won't necessarily see the destruction of the planet. Of course, David Goodall was less optimistic than that. And on the journey to when I was taking him in down to Life Circle, the day he was to die, he went along the lines, as an ecologist for the last so many years that he'd been working, that he was pessimistic about the future of the planet, that he felt that there was the planet was exceeding its carrying capacity, as he described it, and that something he felt was probably cataclysmic was going to happen. And when I then suggested, well, I think he suggested the words were, so I'm getting out just in time, anyway, was the way he saw it, because he really did predict a difficult future for all of us who were still here, and that he had been able to, he thought, make this choice in good time. So I don't know. I don't know which way things are going, but I want to see, certainly I want to do what I can to try and make, to lessen that likelihood of some form of cataclysm. And I think getting into a situation where elderly people who certainly want to take this step, and that is relieve the pressure on the planet, should be able to take that step as easily and make it as available as possible.
Well, I think they definitely tie in together with, you know, just changing the perception of or I guess the baggage that's around death. And I think as soon as people start to see a bit of light to you know, associated with what death is and that process and accepting it and not being in fear of it, then that obviously opens up the mind to accept a lot of different things that are attached to it, and including making a decision and yourself as to, you know, when it's the best time to move on.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's definitely an interesting time to be around, and I'm hoping that the people that listen to this, and it's a different segment of people, and it's varying ages, but a lot of younger people, and I think a lot of people that I know have had some experience with a loved one or a friend, like a friend or a family member that has gone through, you know, a horrible experience, and so I think that this will strike a chord one way or the other with everybody that's listening, but I hope that it opens up the mind a little bit and people get a little bit of a different perspective on the whole issue.
Well, I do too. That sounds really good.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to let you go. I know you got a plane to catch, in a little while, so I'll let you pack up and get ready to go to London. But all the best, and thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to following your work more so in the future.
Oh, okay. I'll look forward to it too. So when you get it all organised, let us know, and so I can follow it up and make sure I can tweet it, etc., etc.
Oh, that'd be appreciated. Thank you very much. I'll be in touch. I'll shoot you an email.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone. If you want to reach out to Philip and learn more about his organisation, Exit International, you can go to exitinternational.net. And Philip's also on Twitter as well, so you can go and search for him on there. But I'll put all of his links, everything that we spoke about, all the articles in the show notes over at andysocial.net. There is so much media on the internet about this topic and about Philip as well. So I'll try not to dump War and Peace into the show notes, but I'll reference all of the things that we spoke about in this chat. So if you want to learn more, go over there, andysocial.net, click on the episode show notes for this one, and I'll have everything over there for you guys. And for anyone that listened to that chat and they came away from it not convinced and still, I guess, you know, somewhat on the other side of the fence, you know what, that's fine. And I just hope that you got something out of that chat, and, you know, you continue to have an open mind and take in information and perspectives from other people. And who knows, maybe with a few more experiences and a few more conversations and reading up and learning about different things, that, you know, opinions may change, as mine do personally over the years. My opinions always change, and I find myself contradicting myself all the time. But you remain open and you absorb information and you take it in and you work out what to keep and what to disregard. And I hope that you guys do that as well. And that's the most that we can ask of each other. So thank you very much for everyone that gave that a shot. And I really loved that chat. I think it was absolutely fantastic. So andysocial.net, go and click on the show notes for this episode and learn more. Now, before we wrap it up, I was just going to do the usual spiel before we wrap up the episode, but I thought I'd just do a couple of quick things. For any of the guys that are big Lorde fans and have been following the band for a while, definitely changing topic dramatically here, guys. I just thought I'd give you a few different updates with regards to the band. So, a few things. We've announced two shows. We're going to be playing in Melbourne at Max Watts, on the 22nd of September, and that's part of the Metal United Down Under festivals that are held on the 22nd of September around the country in every capital city and some of the larger regional towns as well. And it's cool to be a part of that. That's been going on for a few years now, and it seems to get better and better each year. So it's great to be headlining the Melbourne date, and we're playing with Vanishing Point and Alarum and a whole range of other amazing bands, predominantly from Melbourne, but I think there's a couple of interstate bands that are on there as well. You can go over to OzTix and MoshTix. I think MoshTix has got a t-shirt ticket combo there, so you can go and grab that stuff. And if you really, really want to support us and support the show and the Metal United Down Under concept, then definitely get your tickets in advance, because that will definitely support and it will help legitimize a lot of the hard work that these guys are putting into, you know, putting on great original music in this country. And Melbourne's fantastic for that sort of stuff anyway, so there's no dramas there. But if you want to get in early, grab a ticket, you can certainly do so. The other show that we're doing, we're only doing two shows this year, unless Lars from Metallica calls me up and says, hey, you know, let's play some shows together. I doubt that'll happen, but if it does, then I'll change my tune. But we're doing two shows this year, and the second show being the 3rd of November, the second day of the Steel Assassins Festival in Sydney, and we're playing at the Bullface Stag. So day one is being headlined by Hobbs Angel of Death, and day two is being headlined by us. So you can go over and purchase tickets through Moshtix. Just search for Steel Assassins, or you can search for Lord Sydney, and you'll be able to find them. I'll have some links. Actually, there, if you click on the Lord shows on the Andy Social website, I'll have the ticket links there for you guys to check out. So two shows. It's been a hell of a long time since we played a gig. It's been 3 years since we played Melbourne, long overdue, but, you know, we've been doing other things in between. So it's good to get back and start to dust off the cobwebs. We've got a new album coming out later this year, which is my other update. We've finished writing, and we've begun the process of recording, which I think the timeline that we put in place will mean that this is going to come together very quickly if all goes to plan. So it's amazing how long it's taken since the last studio album and how quickly it's all coming together now. So we're really happy with the writing of this album and the songs that are there. We haven't reinvented the wheel. This is pretty much Lord as we're known for, and I think it's a blend of the last two studio albums being Set in Stone and Digital Lies. So if you like those albums, I've got a pretty strong belief that you'll enjoy the new ones. So there'll be more information coming soon. All the songs are there. The song titles are there. The album titles are there. There's album concept artwork in place, and we're just waiting for that to be done. So we're getting there. And I guess one of the biggest challenges we've got at the moment, apart from actually recording the thing, yeah, probably the most important thing, is working out what we want to do with the album and how we release it. Do we want to shop this around? Do we want to try and get a label involved? Or do we want to keep doing what we're doing? Because we're pretty content and pretty happy with the way that we've been managing the band internally and really sort of being independent. We've had a lot of success, and the financial sort of returns have made a lot more sense. We've got a lot more control and ownership of our music. So we'll see. There's definitely advantages of being on a label and getting more exposure and distribution and opportunities for bigger shows and all sorts of stuff. But, yeah, we'll see. So that's something that we'll have to debate over and discuss within the camp, and we'll see what the outcome's going to be. But, nonetheless, we're looking for a 2018 release. So we hopefully will have some announcements in the near future. So there's your Lord update. Now, also Self-Starter, a quick update regarding that. Still going strong. The blogs have slowed down quite a bit, just due to a hell of a lot of stuff on, but I've got about 20 drafts there ready to go, so I just need to sit down and churn a few of those out. But I'm really, really looking for a lot of suggestions from people that are running their own small business. They've just started, or they're looking to do it. I want to find people that are just self-employed in general, or anybody that just earns a little money on the side, you know, a little bit of spare change, a bit of beer money, whatever it is. And I'm really looking for... Well, I'm looking for a mix. I'm looking for traditional, very bland and basic and simple, because I want to encourage people to face their fears. And the best way of doing that is showing simple concepts that can get people started. But I also want the left field things, the things that are a little bit unusual, and you sort of go, wow, that's really interesting. I never thought that you could make money doing that. So I'm looking for all sorts of things. And primarily I'm looking in regional Australia, but I'm also looking pretty much anywhere in the country. So regional Australia is a bit close to me, especially where I live down the south coast of New South Wales. And I think it'd be great to show more people in or outside of the metro areas in Australia that there are still plenty of opportunities, even though you're away from the larger built-up areas in this country. But I'm looking for pretty much anyone in Australia. And as the podcast grows, then I will look abroad as well. But, you know, slow and steady, we're getting there. So thank you so much for everyone that supports that podcast as well. And please continue to share them around. If you've got friends that are thinking of dabbling in the self-employment world, please introduce them to the podcast. If you've got friends that are just starting a business, or they've been in the business for a little while and you think they might get something out of it, please pass the podcast on to them as well. But I'm really, really happy and proud with the progress that it's been having, and I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes in the future as well. So, there's a couple of updates there. So I'm going to wrap it up right now. Thank you so much for the support, as always. And thank you once again to Daniel for the guest suggestion. It's going to be an upcoming episode of the Andy Social Podcast. Shout out to Daniel, and please send me a message. And just thank you so much to everyone that's supporting buying merch, sending money through PayPal via my Shout Me a Beer button on the antisocial.net page, leaving reviews, retweeting, liking, commenting, sharing, all the social media stuff. It means a hell of a lot, and I just really appreciate it. And I have so many episodes banked up. I went hard the last few weeks recording episodes, and I have the most eclectic, random mix of people. And this episode was a taste of what's to come. So lots and lots of interesting people. So I'm really, really excited to share these great conversations with you all. So until next week, guys, take care, and we'll speak very, very soon. Larry, please.